At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today's report on gross domestic product sounds like a bad joke you'd hear at an economist's convention. When is 1% negative GDP actually a positive? Oh, I don't know. How about right now? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Scratchpad blog. Host Scott Jagow keeps you updated on business news worth talking about. Available daily at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, the end of July. Great to have you with us. You know, this is no easy thing for me to say, but sometimes I'm not the best guy to actually deliver the day's news. So today, I'm going to let somebody else do it. I'll just comment and clarify where appropriate.
This morning, the GDP revealed that the recession we faced when I took office.
He's talking about first quarter gross domestic product here, January through March.
Was even deeper than anyone thought at the time.
That is, the economy shrank at an annual rate of 6.4%.
But the GDP also revealed that in the last few months, the economy has done measurably better than we had thought.
The last few months would be April through June, the second quarter. GDP shrank at a rate of just 1%.
Better than expected.
Best guesses had been for a decline of 1.5%.
And as many economists will tell you, that part of the progress is directly attributable to the Recovery Act.
So that's a little bit of bragging there. The Recovery Act is better known as the President's Stimulus Program.
This and other difficult but important steps that we've taken over the last 6 months have helped us put the brakes on the recession.
Or so the conventional wisdom goes, the president hopes. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon had a question, though.
What do you think? Is the worst over?
This economy is clearly making a transition from recession to recovery.
Ken Mayland was crunching today's numbers at Clearview Economics. He's convinced they show a turnaround has begun, thanks mainly to government stimulus efforts. They also show another rise in the personal savings rate, and he says that's a promising sign that consumers will fill the gap when the government money goes away.
This is typically what you see in a recovery. With improved confidence, people will start working down their savings rate, which means increasing their spending rate, and that helps get the juices flowing in the economy.
Most economists do expect to see a relative surge in growth for the rest of the year, but many doubt its staying power. State and local budgets also played a key role in lifting the economy, but they're now tapped out, so their contribution won't be repeated. And TD Bank chief economist Joel Naroff warns that the recession has been so deep, recovery is relative.
We're at the bottom in so many things, and it's very easy to get a small increase and get a large percentage change. That tells us growth looks really good, but I call that a head fake.
Once the stimulus money is spent, Naroff worries consumers will still be digging out from under record debt, weak wage growth, and as President Obama pointed out today, lingering unemployment.
As far as I'm concerned, we won't have a recovery as long as we keep losing jobs.
The president warned it won't feel like a recovery overnight. Economist Ken Mayland agrees.
What I think the public has in mind with the word recovery is a full return to better times, and that's not going to be the case for a long time.
As Mayland explains it, recovery is not the same as recovered. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Say this for the House of Representatives. They are not ducking out early to get started on their summer vacations. A bill the House passed today would change the way big banks can pay their executives. Shareholders get a non-binding vote. There's a new risk-reward curve, too. The vote comes after a report from New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. He says some banks that got bailout money paid bonuses last year that were more than their total profits. Think about that for a second. From New York, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on what today's House vote could mean for Wall Street.
One of the more controversial parts of this bill involves curbs on risk-taking. Regulators will be able to ban incentives that encourage too much risk, and not just for banks that accepted government aid, but any financial institution with more than $1 billion in assets. Lucian Bebchuk teaches law at Harvard.
That's an element that could potentially be quite consequential. Depending on whether regulators indeed make substantial use of the power.
Bebchuk says regulators could force banks to tie bonuses to long-term performance rather than short-term profits. Eric Moskowitz is a compensation consultant at Options Group. He favors some sort of clawback provision, meaning the firm could take back some of a trader's income if a risky bet didn't pay off.
If the people are under the understanding that there's some sort of long-term effect on the individual who's putting on these positions, then I think they will think about it more on a larger scale versus looking at it as a way to make this year's bonus bigger.
In addition to the shareholder vote on pay, the bill requires independent compensation committees on boards. Committee members would have to be free of financial ties to the company or its executives. Compensation specialist Grafe Crystal doubts the say-on-pay measure will be effective. He says boards have been ignoring shareholders for years. Why stop now? And he says regulators will be up against some very smart lawyers and compensation consultants.
It'll be Lions 5, Christian 0. And this happens every time. So the people will game the system. They'll come up with a way to get around it.
The Senate is expected to take up the issue in September after the summer break. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Crazy as this sounds, there's a government stimulus program that is so successful it's actually running out of money. The $1 billion Cash for Clunkers plan offers as much as $4,500 to car owners who trade in their old gas hogs for more fuel-efficient models. But as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, there are some objections to adding more money to the pot.
The Department of Transportation estimates dealers across the country have sold roughly 250,000 cars under the Cash for Clunkers program.
Well, it's probably in 31 years the most action at one time I've ever seen.
Don Mushin is the general manager at a Toyota dealership in Hollywood, California. He says he's done 65 clunker deals, more than double normal sales, since the program went into effect on Monday. That kind of stimulus is crucial for economic recovery, says David Cole with the Center for Automotive Research.
People are scared, they're not spending, and this is the kind of thing that can create some momentum, could be a significant accelerating factor in the economy.
But numbers can be deceiving, says Jeremy Anwill, CEO of Edmunds.com.
So there's clearly extra traffic at dealerships, extra sales, seem to be occurring, but the truth of the matter is that we're really paying people to trade in clunkers that they would have traded in anyway over the summer. And we're not creating a lot of new business. We're just concentrating it over an effect this last week.
Anwill says Cash for Clunkers has created a bubble in new car sales, one funded by taxpayer money. He says the program is clunky and costly. Toyota dealer Don Mushin says he's had to invest in paperwork and clunker recycling and hopes the government reimbursement will come quickly.
So as of right now, we're out about $175,000.
Still, Mushin likes the program. He says the buzz is attracting non-clunker customers, too. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. for Marketplace.
Non-clunker customers, say that 10 times fast. No huge market bump or bottom from that GDP number today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. British Airways announced a loss today, not huge in the Detroit or American banking sector model, just $200 million, but still big enough. Other European full-service airlines have been taking losses as well. Air France, KLM, and Lufthansa reported sharply lower earnings this past week. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London that the bad results could force more European carriers to fly the American way.
At British Airways, the voice emanating from the corporate cockpit is not reassuring. Chief Executive Willie Walsh has no soothing words about flying through a little bit of turbulence.
Some people think that this is a temporary downturn and it can be addressed by, you know, temporary solutions. I don't see it that way. This industry, the airline industry, and British Airways as part of it, has been robbed of 4 or 5 years of growth.
He says full-service carriers like BA have got to cut costs to survive, and that means, among other things, cutting out some of those little in-flight extras, meals and drinks, which European passengers currently get for free. Howard Wealdon of the BGC Group says BA is setting out on the American route.
The Americans have led the way in terms of taking out cost and squeezing whatever they can from the passenger. And it is, I'm afraid, the way forward. British Airways is definitely following the US lead.
At the moment, BA is just nibbling at the edges. Free sandwiches have been scrapped on some short-haul flights. Chocolates and hot towels in club class may be next. Keith McMullen of Aviation Economics says the trend is clear. Europeans are being forced to adopt the more Spartan American way of flying.
European carriers have to some extent held out against this, even on the short haul, and that is now changing. So to that extent, the differences are narrowing between the two sets of carriers.
Meanwhile, the budget carriers are pushing to make their service even more rudimentary. Ryanair has famously proposed charging passengers to use the restroom. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
You know, for the last week in July, things have actually been pretty busy the past 5 days. You've got the healthcare debate, gross domestic product this morning, and market rally that seems to have some legs. Joining us for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond are business writer Heidi Moore and Reuters blogger Felix Sim. Good to have you both back again, guys.
Good to be here, Kai.
Likewise, Kai.
Here's what we're going to do. We are going to touch briefly on healthcare because, frankly, it's been in the news oh so much lately. But the question for you, and I guess Felix will start with you, is about the message of healthcare. Has somehow the White House lost control of the message that's out there?
I think they might have done. No one really is talking to the White House talking points, and everyone's very confused about what's in the bill, what's not in the bill, what people are trying to do, what might happen, what isn't going to happen. And so without any clear thing to agree with or disagree with, it's very hard to get a lot of momentum behind what it is that you want to do.
And part of that is because the thing is ridiculously complicated. There's a couple of bills in the Senate, a couple of committees in the House, and let's acknowledge that up front. But Heidi, about this, the issue of the politics of it, what do you think?
Just on the sheer politics of it, it actually helped me understand something that happened on Meet the Press last week, where Hillary Clinton was raving about Obama and just talking about how great he is, and he's so smart, and he's so tall, and he makes all his own clothes, and
yeah.
You know, she was really kind of over the top about it. And I was like, why is she gushing about him? And then I realized, oh, because he's about to walk into this healthcare morass, and she will be vindicated.
Oh, yeah, right. Been there, done that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
She knows how hard it is. And, you know, it's an incredibly hard sell. It doesn't seem like the administration is terribly focused about what they think should be done. And the cost is not incidental. We're so much in debt, and we can't choose a system that doesn't cover everybody, but we can't afford to cover everybody. So how does it work?
Felix, come September, is the president going to have to roll up his shirt sleeves and actually dig into this one? Or can he still stand back and say, I want this, this, and this, and here are the principles, make it happen?
I think he's going to have to bash some heads in Congress, because there's no way that I see that Congress is going to make this happen on its own. There's just this kind of reform fatigue with regulatory reform and various other bills which really do need to pass Congress, like the cap and trade bill. I just get the feeling that Congress is feeling that it's been asked to do too many really enormous things in too little time, and they're tired of it, and they're just picking nits, and they're not going to go along with what the White House says anymore.
All right, having talked about healthcare, let me ask you, in the context of this morning's gross domestic product numbers, how are we doing? I mean, do we deserve to be feeling as good as we're feeling, Heidi?
I struggle with that question. I mean, that's a great question, because, you know, we've all had the same fatigue that Felix was talking about with Congress, the reform fatigue. We're all feeling it in our lives, you know, looking at it in our communities, the people who don't have jobs, the businesses that are closing. And we're so desperate to feel good that we will really seize on any number that will do that. On the other hand, can you really argue against optimism? Because we're nothing without hope. And so that's why I'm not going to say that we're wrong to feel that way.
I'll say that we're wrong to feel that way.
All right, go ahead.
Proceed.
I'm happy to say that, because frankly, I think the main reason that we're feeling hopeful right now, there's only one reason, and that's the financial markets. Mm. The stock market is doing well. The bond market is going gangbusters. As the markets go up, you have everyone going, oh my God, look, the markets are up. We must be full of joy and spring and optimism. But that's really all there is. And, you know, the second quarter GDP numbers were negative. They would have been even more negative, substantially more negative, if it wasn't for federal spending.
Let me ask you this, though, Felix, on those couple of points. One is, can't the government now sit there and say, hey, look, the stimulus plan is working. And oh, by the way, we took it from -6.4% growth to -1%, which is, any way you judge it, 5% better.
They can, and I'm sure they will. And that just means that basically we're at the mercy of government spending. And I'm not confident that that's going to be able to last indefinitely.
Let me switch gears very quickly and ask about something more pleasant, the possibility of a quiet August. Felix?
Can't remember the last time I had a quiet August, and it's about time that we had one.
And that's precisely why we're not going to get one. A quiet August is an absolute trap. More wars start in August than any other month. August is a very tetchy time, and especially right now when you are looking for quote-unquote green shoots, I wouldn't check out of the office.
Heidi Moore, Felix Salmon, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, bidding wars on foreclosed homes.
We'd get excited and we'd bring our kids along and they would, you know, this is my room and then this is, I want to, you know, the backyard and we can do this and that. And really did put a strain on our marriage.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials bumped up 17 points today, not quite 0.2%, to close at 9,171. The NASDAQ shaved off 5 points. That's about 0.3%, settled at 1978. The S&P 500 basically flat, rising less than a point, wrapped up at 987. It was another good week overall, though. The Dow and the S&P 500 each rose 0.8%. The NASDAQ gained 0.6% this week. Steel companies were some of the bright spots in the market today. The two largest steelmakers benefited from rising prices. U.S. Steel hammered home a nearly 3% gain. Rival Nucor deposited 1.25%. Crude oil futures rose more than 3.5% today, up to more than $69 a barrel. Bond prices rose. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Major automakers report July sales figures. We'll see if those numbers were bumped up by the government's incentive program, giving consumers credit toward new, more fuel-efficient cars. The woman with all the tips on living well celebrates her birthday. Martha Stewart turned 68. And on August 3, 1958, the submarine USS Nautilus became the first vessel to get to the North Pole underwater. Gives you chills just thinking about it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
State workers in West Virginia are getting some good news in a gloomy economy. With an unexpected $65 million surplus, West Virginia Governor Joe Manchin is spreading the wealth. He wants to give full-time state employees a one-time $500 salary enhancement, he's calling it. Governor Manchin, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
How did you wind up doing this? There's $65 million in surplus.
We did a complete inventory in trying to get our financial house in order, and we had some of the four of the best years we ever had in the history of the state. And having those record years that we had for revenue, we also downsized state government, paid off debt, and did some things very responsible. And what we had was $57 million of excess, more than what we anticipated from our excess lottery. And we had anywhere between $8 to $15 million in our general revenue.
So this came from lottery winning. So West Virginians are just playing a lot of lottery then.
Well, there's more out-of-state people coming in, thank God, than it is West Virginians. The legislature has been very good, very disciplined. They did not spend it or appropriate it for other things. And the workers and state workers basically lived and did not spend the monies that was appropriated for them.
Overall, though, Governor, how's the economy doing in West Virginia?
Our economy is holding. We're having difficulties. Our unemployment is 9.4%. which is very concerning to me. But basically, we're living within our means. That's the most important thing, and we made the adjustments. And I believe that we should be able to share when we do. And this is one way for me to say thank you on behalf of the people of West Virginia for the job you've done, all the state workers, all the teachers, all the service for everybody.
Have you had to make any cuts to the state workforce in the last couple of years?
I have not made any cuts to the state workforce. What I've been very careful in doing, Kai, is that I have not increased state employment. When we have anybody that retires or leaves the system, you have to exercise and show a need to replace that person or why we should continue to be hiring. So we have a lot of attrition that we have not replaced.
When you speak with your fellow governors, do they pull you aside at these big conferences you guys go to and say, hey, Joe, how are you doing this?
Well, we talk a lot. I just said we've been blessed. We really have. But we had to get our house in order before this ever hit. There's a correction, a worldwide correction going on, and every state has to go through these corrections. I just knew you couldn't run a state the way we had been doing it in the past. I knew there were some changes that need to be made. And we just hit it perfectly timing-wise.
With today's economic numbers, Governor, before I let you go, are you now pretty hopeful that we've seen the worst of it and things are going to get better?
The best bet is it's going to last a little longer than what any of us would like to see. It's not going to be a quick turnaround, or it's not going to be a prolonged 4 or 5 years out. With that being said, we're going to have to work our way out of this and making sure that we're all in sync. If not, I can guarantee you that this boat won't float.
Governor Joe Manchin from the state of West Virginia. Governor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
There was a time in the U.S. housing market when all you had to do was hang a sign in your front yard that said for sale and then sit back and wait. Oh, what those sellers would give for a good old-fashioned bidding war right now, huh? The Census Bureau tells us 8 million houses are sitting empty due to foreclosure. Prices are in the basement. Bids are few and far between. And so buyers have all the power. Or do they? If you're in the market for one of those foreclosed homes, you might just find yourself taking a trip back in time. From KQED, Rob Schmitz reports.
Nice home, nice view of the mountains and stuff.
Joe Cusimano wipes the sweat off his brow as he gives a tour of a 5-bedroom home in the city of Corona, an hour east of Los Angeles.
You can see it's very open floor plan, and that's where the clients like it. They're going to make this their dining area.
Cusimano could be sweating because it's 100 degrees inside. The house was foreclosed on months ago and lies vacant in the desert sun. He might also be sweating because his clients are competing with at least 5 other offers. Bidding wars are back, and after a year of trying to survive in a terrible market, Cusimano is once again a busy guy.
I have another property in West Hills. We put it up for sale on July 3rd. We had 5 offers July 4th. I was getting phone calls during July 4th, and I was taking them, and my wife was very upset with me, but, you know, business is business.
And all this business is not what new home buyers were expecting.
I thought people didn't buy houses right now because, you know, the situation is really hard, economy-wise and everything.
Alma Montaño and her husband Jose started looking for a home a few months ago. They wanted to take advantage of an $8,000 federal tax credit for first-time home buyers. They found a house halfway between L.A. and Palm Springs and bid $13,000 over the asking price. They were beat out by a higher bidder. They were interested in another home, but when they found out there were 30 offers on it, they gave up. Just a few miles away, Chris Reynolds was also looking to buy.
And after a week or two of looking at homes in the process, we were starting to get discouraged.
Reynolds began looking for a home for his family in December. The 41-year-old figured he'd find a place by the end of June when their lease was set to expire. But when he and his wife bid on their first property, they lost out in a bidding war. The next weekend, it happened again and again.
We would visit them, we would look at it, we'd like the neighborhood, and we'd get excited, and we'd bring our kids along, and they would, you know, this is my room, and then this, I want to, you know, the backyard, and we can do this and that. And it really did put a strain on our marriage.
In 4 months, the Reynolds made offers on 20 foreclosed properties. All of them had multiple bids that went over the asking price set by the bank that owned the property. But instead of accepting an offer, many banks would take the house off the market and relist it a month later at a higher price. This happened over and over, says Reynolds.
To me, it didn't make any sense. I think they were just getting a feel for what they could get for that house. So it's 4 bedrooms in all, and this is actually our room.
The Reynolds finally had the winning bid on this 3-bedroom home after months of frustration. Real estate agent Joe Cusimano says the banks are overwhelmed by mortgage defaults and loan modifications. He says they're in such a hurry to unload these foreclosed properties that they often don't know what they're worth.
It's probably exasperating when they have to field so many calls and emails and stuff like that, too. But I still think the banks should put something in place to make the system work a lot quicker than what it's working.
Cusimano doesn't expect the bidding wars will last, especially after the tax incentives for first-time homebuyers run out in December. He says without the tax credit and with another surge of foreclosures expected this winter, home prices will just go back down. In Los Angeles, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, it being a Friday afternoon and all, it's time to leave the big news behind and let Rico Galliano do that thing he does. Talk to the Marketplace staff about some of the stories that didn't make the headlines. The kinds of things you might want to talk about at a dinner party this weekend.
George Judson, managing editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Beer.
So what else is new? No, why?
A brewery in Scotland just put out the highest alcohol content beer in the UK, 18.2%.
Because if there's one thing the Brits need, it's more alcohol in their diet.
Well, their argument is that their beer is so filling that you just can't drink too much of it.
So the strongest beer in the UK is going to curb binge drinking.
Well, as one critic said, if the average-sized woman drank one bottle of this, that would be binge drinking.
Nancy Fargali, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The Gallup poll released a survey this week that said Americans hate the Fed more than they hate the IRS.
Yeah, this is like losing to Stalin in a popularity contest.
Yeah.
It does make sense though, right? Because when the IRS comes knocking at your door, you know how they're going to mess with you. If the Fed shows up, even after they explain it, you won't know what they're doing.
I'm not sure they know either.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace, go.
Well, you know the Snuggie, the blanket with sleeves that people are wearing? They make it for dogs now.
You are kidding me.
No. Check it out.
Now there's Snuggie Dog, the little blanket with sleeves designed to fit your dog.
Stop it. It's too much.
This, you know, might be the downscaling equivalent of like Louis Vuitton making matching dog and people outfits. Now you can just have a matching Snuggie.
We can all look like morons together.
Yes, but warm morons.
That is just a taste of what Rico can do. The full podcast is called The Dinner Party Download. There is a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow picked up 17 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 5 points, about 0.3%. The S&P flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance program, Marketplace Money, it's called, even couples who are a perfect match still argue over one thing.
My pet peeve related to my spouse when she monitors how much I spend.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.